Chapter 35. The guy was about 40 years old, give or take, right up there on a hard-won plateau in the center of his life. Not a dumb kid anymore, but not yet an old man either, and full of accumulated competence and confidence and capability, all wrapped up in experience. He looked to be dead on 6 feet tall, and about 200 pounds. He was wearing blue jeans, coarse and high-waisted, not stylish at all, with a belt and a white open-neck shirt and a blue satin baseball jacket. He had fair hair cut short and neatly brushed, and a pink, slabby face, and small blue eyes, and an inquiring expression. He could have been a neighborhood electrical contractor, showing up in person to prepare a detailed estimate for a difficult job, except for the gun in his hand, which looked like an old Ruger P-85, 9mm, with a suppressor tube attached, a silencer, about 9 inches long. The guy was holding the gun down by his leg, pointed at the floor. With the suppressor tube, it ran from the middle of his thigh to the middle of his calf. Long and slender. A random circuit in the back part of Reacher's brain sparked up with a play-by-play. He flew short notice from L.A. and can't have taken a gun on the plane, so he has operational support in Chicago at a fairly high level, given that suppressors are illegal in the state of Illinois. The front part of his brain said, "Step forward." He stepped forward. The gun came up, and the guy said,
"Don't move."
Reacher stepped forward again, all the way to the door. The guy said, "I'll shoot." "You won't, because you want to shoot me in the room, not in the doorway, because I'm too big to move afterward, and also because in real life suppressors don't work like they work in the movies, with a polite little spit, but with a hell of a bang. Not much quieter than a regular gunshot anyway, which will be audible all over the house if you fire in the hallway. So you won't shoot. Not yet." The guy said,
"Stay where you are."
The back of Reacher's brain said, "If he has operational support in Chicago, you should check for reinforcements. Muscle is cheaper than silencers here." Which was why he had pushed his luck all the way to the door, to get the angle. But there was nothing in the dim shadows beyond the guy's shoulder. No bulk, no sound, no shifting stance, no breathing. The guy was alone. Reacher stood still. The guy said,
"Back inside, now."
From the room, Chang said,
"What do you want?"
"You're not going to say you want to shoot us, nothing personal, purely business, because that would induce a measure of last-ditch defense on our part." The guy said,
"I want to talk."
"About what?"
"About what's happening in Mother's Rest. I think I can help you."
"And you have a bridge for sale in Brooklyn. I wasn't born yesterday." Reacher stayed right where he was, filling the doorway, angled slightly, his front toe on the seam between the hallway floor and the room floor, with the guy about a yard in front of him, halfway to the staircase railing, and Chang about 2 yards behind him, still halfway into the room. She said,
"If you're here to help us, why did you bring a gun?"
The guy didn't answer. Reacher had failed driving, but he had passed everything else, including unarmed combat, which sounded like a useful qualification, but wasn't. The whole point of the military had been to engage with hot weapons at minimum risk to the home side. In other words, to shoot the other guy from a very long way away with a rifle, or failing that, to shoot him closer by with a handgun. The unarmed combat courses had been afterthoughts. There had been a whiff of embarrassment. Hand-to-hand implied failure
at the hot weapons stage. Worst of all, the pointy heads couldn't find anything to write in the manual. There were no valid theories. Martial arts didn't work in the real world. Judo and karate were useless without the mats and the referee and the special pajamas. So unarmed combat was brawling, basically, like a bar fight. Whatever worked. Chang said,
"Put the gun down and we'll talk."
He won't, because that would give up his only advantage. He would be one-on-one with a giant, which was not appealing, especially because right then the giant was fixing him with the glassy stare of a psychopath. Whatever worked. The guy kept the gun where it was. Reacher leaned forward an inch. "He wants to shoot me in the room, not the doorway. I'm too big to move." The guy said,
"Back up now."
Reacher said nothing. "I'm too big to move." And then it shifted. The man with the gun was no longer in charge, no longer in control. He was being pushed back, inch by inch, because of relentless pressure. Not physically. The tip of the suppressor didn't move. But in his mind, the man with the gun felt battered by a sudden and unexplained reversal of fortune, and he felt roasted by some kind of death rays coming out of the psychopath's eyes. Reacher said,
"Don't worry."
Brawling, all in the head. Win them before you get in them. He said, "Let's see if we can help you out of this mess." His standard procedure, such as it was, based on what had worked for a right-handed person facing a right-handed gunman, was to drive slightly forward but mostly counterclockwise, a savage rotation from the waist, explosive, exaggerated like a dance move with the right shoulder whipping hard around, therefore the right elbow whipping hard around, and the right hand and the right palm, the palm smacking hard against the inside of the bad guy's wrist and then pushing it hard, pushing the gun out of orbit, then clamping on like a claw, the other hand meanwhile coming palm to palm with the gun hand, the left against his right, like dancing, like fighting over the gun, but it's not fighting over the gun. It's pushing the gun hand back and back, all the time dragging the wrist forward with the claw until the wrist breaks and the gun drops. But you can save yourself a lot of effort because he's got a suppressor. That gun is twice as long as his muscle memory thinks it is, which makes it easy. Go the short route. Which Reacher did, twisting hard from the waist, but short, keeping his palm hooked close to his body, smacking not the guy's wrist, but the suppressor itself, pushing it wide and safe, then grasping it and hauling on it hard. A standard procedure, so called because it was often used like a default setting, because 99 times in 100 it worked. But this was the 100th guy. He knew what to do. He didn't allow himself to get hauled around off balance by keeping hold of the gun. He let go of it, right away, instantly. He gave it up, no contest. He just dropped it and spun away. It was his only smart play. It was 1 in 100. It was a smart play because even though it gave Reacher sole possession of a lethal weapon, it gave him possession of it the wrong way around. He had grabbed it by the suppressor in his right hand, palm outward, and he was still rotating away from the action and the dead stop and the right-left-right shuffle to get the gun where it needed to be was going to occupy some finite slice of time. And then, turning the barrel toward the target was going to occupy another slice, maybe longer, because it was a long barrel with the suppressor in place, not point and shoot, more like lashing the guy with a whip,
which would all take what? A second and a half? 2 seconds? During which time, a guy smart enough to start such a play will be hitting you in the side of the head. He'll be raining down the blows, maybe 4 in your 2 seconds if he's any good with the speed bag. Better to let the gun go for the time being. Better to come back to it later. Better to get ready for what you know is coming. Reacher opened his hand and the Ruger fell away, and he started to unwind his counterclockwise twist, bringing his elbow up backhand, ducking his head down, and the first of the incoming blows bounced off the top of his skull. And then a left hook caught him above the ear, a savage blow like an iron bar, and then his own elbow arrived in the neighborhood, scything a kind of defensive no-fly zone through the nearby air, butting aside the next incoming right, and he used its momentum to pull a left hook of his own out of the bag. But the bang above the ear had set back the unwinding process an inch or two, so his blind aim was off, and the punch landed weakly, in that it didn't knock the guy through the staircase railing, but merely bounced him off it. At which point, the guy showed yet more talent. Naturally, Reacher was leaning in, waiting to finish it, waiting for the guy to come flopping back all loose and raggedy and defenseless. But the guy jerked away, sideways, at 90 degrees. A supreme gymnastic effort. Remarkable for a big man. And a lifesaver. With a bonus. Not only had the guy escaped a colossal impact, but now Reacher had his weight on the wrong foot. So the guy took advantage by stepping in a pace and crashing a short left into Reacher's kidney, which Reacher felt would leave a bruise. Then the guy stepped back the same pace, like a boxer, to a neutral corner. He stood there, alert but not moving and looking pretty confident. The Ruger was on the hallway carpet, about halfway between Reacher's feet and his. It was aimed at neither one of them. It was pointing to the side, as yet undecided, like an emperor's thumb, neither up nor down, not exactly halfway between them, closer to Reacher, if anything. How long to get it? Long enough to get your head kicked in, or shot through the heart. Reacher checked the guy's clothes. The satin jacket was thin and showed no bulges or heavy weights. It was falling open with nothing to hide. The blue jean pockets were puffed out innocently. Just air and Kleenex. Therefore, his backup weapon would be on his belt, in a pancake holster in the small of his back, as supplied by his local operational support. Not the fastest draw in the world, but a lot faster than a tall guy bending down and trying to scrabble up a small pistol off the floor, all unbalanced with 9 inches of extra metal. Hence the confidence, which he wouldn't feel if he was heading for a fist fight. No one had before. But this guy looked pretty good. He had only one minor concern, Reacher supposed, which was that Reacher didn't really need to pick up the Ruger as such. All he really needed to do was get a foot on it and scrape it backward between his legs to Chang. That would be a game changer. But difficult and slow, a clumsy, unnatural movement. Plus then the finite slice of time it would take Chang to grab it up herself and set and aim and fire. Not the fastest straw in the world, but faster than that, almost certainly. So a concern, but minor. Time to mess with his head. Reacher stepped backward. One long pace, the proportions changed. Now the Ruger was nearer the guy, who then stepped forward, closer to it. Inevitably, human nature right there. Hard to push them back, easy to suck them in. The guy would have made a big point of standing his ground against forward pressure of any kind, but he showed no such determination in the other direction. He stepped right up. His first mistake, a weakness he didn't understand. He thought any length of rooming house hallway was as good as any other. In fact, he thought his new position was better, because it put the Ruger right at his feet. He could reclaim it any old time he wanted to. Then he would have two guns, and Reacher would have none. Better, but not really, because of the temptation, because of the urgency. The guy had two weapons within easy reach, but neither one was actually in his hand. So near, and yet so far. He was consumed by all the future possibilities. He was thinking ahead to the heavy, solid feel, the ribbed grips rough against his palm, the trigger warm and hard under his finger, invulnerability, victory, job done, so close. After nothing more than dipping down and up again for the Ruger, real fast and swooping, or batting his satin jacket aside and scrabbling around behind his back to the holster and drawing and aiming and firing. Nothing more than that. So close. Temptation. Urgency. But either maneuver would take time. A second or so. Maybe more. And either maneuver would be a clear signal. There would be no ambiguity. Reacher would know exactly what was coming next, and he was only two paces away. He was a big guy, but clearly mobile. And how mobile did he need to be? Trying for the Ruger meant a kick in the face, surely. Reacher would take one step and bang, right-footed after a little shuffle like punting a football. The target would be right there, in the right place, at the right time, at the right height, on a tee, begging for it, his face. And trying for the holster meant a kick in the nuts, equally surely. He would be fighting with one hand behind his back, literally. His elbow would be bent in a weird position. He would be wide open. Two weapons within easy reach, but neither one in his hand. Temptation. Urgency. Distraction. Reacher took half a step closer, compressing the geometry, reducing the range, sharpening the focus, upping the pressure face to face, 5 feet apart. The guy kept still on the surface, but Reacher could see underneath. The guy was quivering, a physical manifestation of his dilemma. He wanted to duck down or reach around, one or the other, or both, uncontrollable. He kept starting and stopping, microscopically, trying it this way, trying it that way. Little shakes and judders. His eyes were moving up and down, so near and yet so far. Reacher said, "What's your name?" The guy said, "Why?" We seem to have made each other's acquaintance. We might as well introduce ourselves formally. Why? Might be a smart move on your part. Might make me think about you as a person, not just an opponent. I might not hit you so hard. That's the conventional wisdom these days. Victims need to humanize themselves. Shakes and judders, eyes going up and down, so near and yet so far. The guy said, "I'm not a victim." Reacher said, "Not yet." Behind him, Chang said, "This doesn't need to end badly. Step back and raise your hands. Then we'll talk, and we can fix this. You haven't done anything to us yet." The guy didn't answer. His eyes were going up and down. Reacher could see he wanted to use the Ruger, and why not? It was his original weapon of choice, for a reason, presumably, and it had the suppressor. It was operationally superior, sentimentally superior, too.
which maybe the guy didn't know yet, in the front part of his brain. But it was working on him. He could pick up the Ruger and he'd be right back at the beginning, like starting over, like nothing happened. He could pick up the Ruger and make himself whole again. Reacher said, "What's your name?" The guy said,
"Keith Hackett.
I'm Jack Reacher. I'm pleased to meet you." The guy didn't answer. Reacher said, "But you already know our names." No reply. "So, that's the price. Like my colleague said, this doesn't have to end badly. Not for you, at least. All you have to do is tell us who told you our names, who gave you this job, who you call every night with a progress report. You tell us that, and we'll let you walk away." No response. "It's a simple concept, Mr. Hackett. You tell us, you walk away. You don't tell us, you don't walk away. Maybe you can't walk away. These things are unpredictable. Injuries can be serious." No answer. "Think of those old signs for crossing the street," Reacher said, "when they did them with words, 'Walk' or 'Don't walk, Mr. Hackett.' That's the issue here." The guy waited a beat, suddenly still for the very first time, and then he went for the Ruger. He powered down, faster than gravity, his eyes on the prize, his hands already moving, rehearsing the scoop, his face averted because of what he knew must be coming, but what he hoped could be beat. It couldn't. The guy's face was turned away, high and back, so Reacher's boot caught him under the chin, like a monstrous uppercut from a heavyweight with a horseshoe in his glove. The guy went over backward and laid out full length, but to his credit he knew he was dead if he stayed there, so he skidded once and then crabbed and scrambled away, all elbows and knees, and he got himself upright, shrugging and blinking and pawing the air. He didn't look good. He had a broken jaw, obviously, missing teeth, which were serious injuries, but neither in a technical sense, a referee would say, were also debilitating injuries under the current circumstances, unless the guy was planning to start his victory feast any time soon. Reacher watched the guy's right hand. He figured it could move only one of three ways. Smartest would be straight up in surrender. Dumbest would be another fist. Therefore, the second dumbest would be the same as the second smartest, which would be to go for the holster. The guy went for the holster. Didn't get there. His arm moved back, and his elbow came out, and he flattened his hand to slip it behind his back, and his left hand moved in awkward sympathy, counterbalancing, and his shoulders opened up, and he went as flat and two-dimensional as if he was pasted on the air, like a paper target, on a wall in an unarmed combat class. Whatever worked. Reacher stepped in a short pace and head-butted the guy full in the face, from fully 3 feet away, plenty of arc through the dim hallway air, plenty of power, plenty of acceleration, a colossal, driving impact. And then suddenly the guy wasn't there anymore, and Reacher was using every muscle in his body to stop himself from following through and head-butting the floor. Then across the stairwell, a room door opened and a white-haired woman stuck her head out. An automatic light came on because of her. She asked,
"Who are you people?"
Chapter 36. The neighbor was a noble old bird, thin and faded, but animated. She seemed to be on the ball. Like many of her generation, she tended toward courtesy and a reluctance to disbelieve. Overtly, at least. Purely out of politeness, Reacher supposed.
He said, "We're putting in a new computer for Mr. McCann, but it's hot up here. This guy fainted."
"Would you like me to call for the ambulance?"
"No, we'll get him inside and give him a glass of water."
"It would be no trouble."
"Ma'am, it's an insurance thing. He's a freelance contractor. It's tough on these guys. He's got an insane deductible. He doesn't want a hospital bill."
"Is there anything else I can do?"
"Not a thing, ma'am." Reacher grabbed Hackett under the arms and started dragging him toward McCann's room. Chang nudged the Ruger with her foot, discreetly, pushing it to safety a few inches at a time. The neighbor started to close her door, and then she changed her mind and opened it again, the same confidential 12-inch gap, and she said,
"I thought Peter always installed his computers himself."
Then she closed up for good, and the hallway went quiet. Chang picked up the Ruger and carried it the rest of the way. Reacher got Hackett inside. Chang closed the door. Hackett had plenty of maxillary damage. That was for damn sure. Pretty much all the facial bones. Some doctor was headed for the lecture circuit. But the guy was breathing pretty well, for the moment, at least, until various internal items swelled up and clotted. After that, it was a gamble. Chang said,
"When will he wake up?"
Reacher said, "I have no idea. Somewhere between 2 hours and never."
"You hit him very hard."
"He hit me first, twice in the head and once in the back."
"Are you okay?"
He nodded. He was okay, but not spectacular. His kidney hurt bad. Movement was not pain-free. And his head hurt worse. There was a sharp pain above his ear. It had been a hell of a blow, maybe the worst he had ever taken. The headbutt had been unwise under the circumstances.
"We can't wait here 2 hours," Chang said. "Anything could happen."
"We need to find McCann, and waiting here is as good a way as any."
"You're not thinking," she said. "Do you have a headache?"
"Not yet, but I will. Why?"
"How did they find us here?"
"I guess this guy followed us. In retrospect, it was obvious we would start at the library."
"But then we took the town car on a crazy route, looping all around the neighborhood to get our bearings. There was no one behind us. There was no one following. How could there be?"
"How then?"
"They have better information about McCann than we do, somehow. Maybe he's done business with them. They have his address, at least. Maybe that's why the door was unlocked, like Kiever's door was unlocked. Maybe Hackett has already been here once this morning."
Something in her voice. Reacher picked up the Ruger and checked the chamber and dropped the mag. Brassy 9mm rounds winked at him. But not enough brassy 9mm rounds. The mag was one short. He sniffed the chamber, sniffed the muzzle. The gun had been fired. Chang said,
"They didn't want us to talk to McCann. There were two ways of stopping us. They chose both."
Reacher checked Hackett's pulse in his neck. It was there, but slow, deeply unconscious, or comatose. Was there a difference? Reacher wasn't sure. Chang said,
"We should assume reinforcements sooner or later."
Reacher said, "This guy could tell us things."
"We don't have time."
"So at least let's get what we can." They got a fancy cell phone, as thin as Chang's, and a rental car key, and a hotel key card, and 85 cents, and a wallet, all from the pockets, and a Heckler and Koch P7 from the holster on the back of the belt. The P7 was small enough to hide, but big enough to use. It shared the same parabellum rounds as the Ruger, which was logistically sensible. The wallet contained more than $100 in cash, and a California driver's license and a bunch of credit cards. Chang kept the cell phone for the call log, and Reacher kept the cash for future expenses and the P7 for a number of reasons. They wiped what they were leaving behind and everything else they had touched. They put their loot in their pockets. Chang said,
"Do we need anything else?"
Reacher took a last look around. He said, "One more thing, perhaps."
"Which would be what?"
"I think we can forget about organic food and honeybees. Look at this place. There's sugary breakfast cereal and factory milk and 2 candy bars. That's what he eats. He wears polyester pants. He doesn't care what he puts in his body, and he's not a tree hugger. Therefore, the LA Times article he reacted to was the deep web thing about the Internet, which would make total sense with all these computers."
"You want to take a computer?"
"Did you hear what the neighbor lady said before she closed her door?"
"She said she thought Peter installed his computers himself. You hadn't convinced her. It was a very polite parting shot."
"She got the words right. Computers are installed, are they not? And she called him Peter. I would have expected an old lady like that to call him Mr. McCann. They must be good friends, like longtime neighbors sometimes are. In which case, maybe they talk about personal matters. And if she knows about computers, maybe he's told her what's on his mind, because she'd understand."
"We don't have time to ask her. There could be more of these guys in this building at any minute. And then the cops?"
"I agree," Reacher said. "We don't have time to ask her. Not here, anyway. Therefore, she's the extra thing I want to bring with us. The neighbor. We should take her out for a cup of coffee, away from here, and we should ask her there." It was not a fast process, not a high-speed getaway. There was some skepticism, some reluctance. In the end, Chang had to play the FBI card, literally. Then there was a search for a coat, even though they told her the weather was warm. But it was a matter of manners. She said she wasn't completely old-fashioned. She wouldn't insist on gloves and a hat. Then came the long, unsteady walk down the steep flights of stairs and out to the street, where it was the town car that overcame her last real reluctance. Its gleaming black paint and its driver in his neat gray suit finally sealed the deal. It was governmental. She had seen such cars on the evening news. Then came Reacher's search for the right kind of place. Many pleasant candidates were rejected. Finally, one was chosen, a traditional Chicago coffee shop, perhaps discreetly updated by a respectful grandson and heir. It had a pleasant atmosphere, as well as a full roster of all the required virtues, which were nearby parking for the town car, and inside seating, and a TV screen on the wall. McCann's neighbor seemed happy with it. Maybe it reminded her of the places she used to frequent. She folded her bony self into a booth and let herself be hemmed in by Chang, who slid in next to her. Reacher sprawled on the opposite bench, sideways, as unthreatening as he could be. All-around introductions revealed her name to be Mrs. Eleanor Hopkins, widow, previously a wife and a laboratory researcher at the university, not only technically literate, but the technical literature with which she was familiar was written, she said, in a very small number of very small ways, in some of the cracks and the edges, by herself, or by people she knew, or knew of, or might have known of, if she had taken some other job at some other time. She said her career had overlapped an interesting period in terms of technical progress. Then she said Peter McCann had lived in her building for a good many years, and they had grown close in a gruff and occasional and good fences kind of a way. She said she had last seen him 3 or 4 weeks ago, which often happened, which was not a cause for concern.
She went out very rarely, and it would be a matter of sheer coincidence if she met him in the hallway. And he was gone a lot anyway, often for days at a time. She had no idea where. She had never inquired. She was his neighbor, not his sister. Yes, he was an unhappy man. Things often turned out badly. The TV on the coffee shop wall was tuned to local news. Reacher watched it in the corner of his eye. Mrs. Hopkins ordered coffee and a slice of cake, and Chang told her it was possible Mr. McCann had gotten himself into some kind of trouble, of a sort no one knew. Did she? She didn't. Reacher asked, "Did he seem obsessed about something?" Mrs. Hopkins asked,
"When?"
"Recently?"
"Yes, I would say he did."
"For how long?"
"About the last 6 months."
Outside there were distant sirens and the dull beat of helicopter blades, maybe a mile away. Reacher asked, "Do you know what Mr. McCann's problem was?"
"No, I don't. We spoke very little of personal matters."
"Was it connected to his son?"
"It might have been, although that tended not to be an up-and-down situation."
The TV screen showed a helicopter shot of green lawns, trees, a park. Reacher asked, "What was the issue with his son?"
Mrs. Hopkins said, "He didn't talk of it in detail."
"Did you know he hired a private detective?"
"I knew he intended to take concrete steps."
"About what?"
"I don't know."
"Did you and he talk about technical matters, given your background and his evident interest?"
"Yes, we talked frequently about technical matters, over coffee and cake sometimes, like this. We explored the issues together. We rather enjoyed it. I helped him grasp the basic structures, and he helped me understand the uses to which they are now often put."
"Was his obsession a technical obsession?"
"I think not at its core, but there were technical aspects."
"Was it something to do with the Internet?" On the TV, under the unsteady green picture, was a ticker tape ribbon with the words, "Shooting victim found in park." The old lady looked up and said,
"By a dog walker, I expect. That's how it usually happens, I think, in parks."
Reacher said, "What was McCann's interest in the Internet?"
"There were aspects he wanted to understand. Like most laymen, he thought of things in physical terms, as if the Internet was a swimming pool chock full of floating tennis balls, the tennis balls representing individual websites, naturally, which is wrong, of course. Websites are not physical things. The Internet has no physical reality. It has no dimensions and no boundaries, no up or down, no near or far. Although one might argue it has mass. Digital information is all ones and zeros, which means memory cells are either charged or not charged. And charge is energy. So if one believes Einstein's E equals mc squared, where E is energy and m is mass and c is the speed of light, then one must also believe that m equals E divided by c squared, which is the same equation expressed differently, and which would imply that charge has detectable mass. The more songs and the more photos you put on your phone, the heavier it gets, only by a trillion billionth of the tiniest fraction of an ounce, but still."
On the TV screen, the helicopter camera zoomed tight on a group of low bushes. There were uniformed cops standing around, and police tape, and a suggestion of a half-concealed figure on the ground, black shoes and black pant legs under leafy branches. The ticker still said, "Shooting victim found in park." Reacher asked, What exactly did McCann want to understand? The old lady said,
He wanted to know why some websites can't be found, which was fundamentally a question about search engines. His image of the swimming pool became useful. He imagined millions of tennis balls, some bobbing up on the water, some trapped deeper down by the weight of the others. So I asked him to imagine a search engine as a long silk ribbon being pulled up and down and in and out, weaving through the balls every which way, sliding over their wet, fuzzy surfaces at tremendous speed, and then to imagine that some balls have been adapted to have spikes instead of fuzz, like fish hooks, and that other balls had been adapted to have no fuzz at all, to be completely smooth like billiard balls. Where would the silk ribbon snag? On the spikes, of course. It would slide over the billiard balls completely. That's what Peter needed to understand about search engines. It's a two-way street. A website must want to be found. It must work hard to develop effective spikes. People call it search engine optimization. It's a very important discipline now. That said, it's equally hard work to be a billiard ball. Staying secret isn't easy either.
Chang said, Secret websites imply illegality.
Indeed, the old lady said. Or immorality, I suppose, or both at once. I'm naive about such things, but one imagines pornography of the most unpleasant sort, or mail order cocaine and so forth. It's called the deep web. All those smooth billiard balls, millions of them. No spikes, no hooks, nothing but going about their business with no one watching. The deep web might be 10 times bigger than the surface web, or 100, or more, no one knows. How could they? Not to be confused with the dark web, of course, which is merely out-of-date sites with broken links, like dead satellites whirling through space forever, which makes the dark web more like ancient archaeology and the deep web more like the wrong side of the tracks. Not that either one is actually dark or deep or either side of any actual tracks, you understand. The Internet is not a physical place. There are no physical characteristics to it at all.
On the TV screen, an ambulance rolled into the overhead shot, slowly over the grass, lights flashing forlornly, being followed by what looked like a coroner's wagon. People got out and joined the cops. Chang asked,
So how can a person find secret websites?
A person can't, the old lady said. Not from the outside, anyway. You can't use a search engine because the sites are smooth. You need the exact address. Not just coffeeshop.com, but something like coffeeshop123xyz.com. Or much worse, of course, in reality. A unique resource locator combined with a super secure password all rolled into one. Apparently, such addresses circulate through certain communities by word of mouth.
On the TV screen, a dark blue Crown Vic bumped over the grass and parked. Two men in suits climbed out. Detectives, presumably. The ticker changed to Lincoln Park Homicide. Richard could hear more helicopters in the air about a mile away, rival channels late to the party. He asked, Did McCann tell you what kind of a website he was looking for? The old lady said,
No.
On the screen, men squatted by the black-clad figure on the grass. Detectives and the medical examiner, Reacher supposed. He knew the drill. He had squatted by horizontal figures many times. Some had been alive. This one wasn't, he knew. There was no urgency, no hustle, no shouting voices, no backboards, no IV lines, no breathing tubes, no chest compressions. Lincoln Park homicide. The old lady said,
"That's Peter, isn't it? Why else would you be asking me about him? Why else would the FBI be interested in me?"
Chang didn't answer either question, and Reacher said nothing, because as the old lady spoke, the TV picture changed to a house, an undistinguished brownstone on an undistinguished street, Peter McCann's brownstone, the old lady's house, where they had been moments before. It was recognizable. It was familiar. The front of it was all lit up by flashing red lights. Cops were running up the stoop. Much too soon for a connection to have been made. The cops in the park hadn't even looked in McCann's pockets yet. They hadn't found the wallet, hadn't checked the driver's license, didn't know who he was, and didn't know where he lived. They were still waiting for the all-clear from the medical examiner. Reacher knew how it worked. He had sat back on his heels many times, just waiting. Death had to be pronounced before the body became evidence. Not yet connected. A separate investigation. The ticker changed to "Anti-Terror Cops Storm Chicago Dwelling." Reacher turned back to the old lady and asked, "Did you call 911? The old lady said,
"Yes, I did."
"When?"
"As soon as I closed my door on you."
"Why?"
"I didn't like the look of you."
"Neither one of us?"
"You especially. You don't look like what you say you are. Not like an FBI agent on the television."
"I was undercover, pretending to be a bad guy."
"Your act was convincing."
"So you called 911?
"Immediately."
"What did you say?"
"I had armed terrorists in my house."
"Why that?"
"This is Chicago. That's the only way to get a response in less than 4 hours.
Chang said,
"We should probably get going."
Reacher said, "No, let's stay a little longer. 5 more minutes can't hurt." They got refills of coffee, and the old lady wanted more cake, so Reacher and Chang got more, too, to keep her company. The TV changed to a split screen, with the park on the left and the house on the right, over individual labels saying, "Lincoln Park Homicide" and "Terror Alert." Both of those labels centered over the main ticker, which said, "Busy day for cops." The second cup of coffee was as good as the first, as was the cake. A body bag showed up in the park, and an ambulance arrived at the house. The body bag was zipped up and carried to the coroner's wagon, and EMTs came out of the ambulance and ran up the stoop and in the house. Later, they came out again with an injured man on a gurney. Hackett, presumably, although it was hard to be sure. The guy's face was bandaged from the neck up, like an Egyptian mummy, and his clothes were covered with a sheet. Then, like a slow-burn visual effect in a movie, the cops drove out of the park, and 4 long minutes later they showed up at the house, in the same cars, all the way from the left of the screen to the right, a short electronic hop, but a circuitous real-world route. The same detectives got out and rushed up the stoop and went inside the house, and a minute later they came back out again, talking urgently on their cell phones. The ticker changed to, "Official says cases are connected." Reacher said, "Ma'am, I'm very sorry for your loss, and I'm very sorry for the intrusion you're about to suffer. The Chicago PD will want to ask you questions, and it's not like it is in the television shows. The FBI can't come in and take over their case. We have to leave them alone.
so we'd appreciate it if you don't even tell them we've talked. There are all kinds of sensitivities there. Better not to tell them about us at all, even about us being at the house earlier. They don't need to know we beat them to it.
Are you asking me to lie to them?
I will, if they ask me who told them terrorists and why.
Then very well, I will too,
the old lady said. Do you really have no idea what McCann's problem was?
I told you, I'm his neighbor, not his sister. You should really ask her.
Who?
His sister.
He has a sister?
I told you before.
I thought it was a figure of speech.
No, she's real. They're very close. She'd be the one he shared secrets with.
Chapter 37. They sent Mrs. Hopkins home in the town car and told the driver that was the last of his engagements for the day, and therefore he was off duty thereafter, free to go home or back to the garage or wherever else it was he was supposed to go. The guy took the news cheerfully, but Reacher figured his last engagement wouldn't be his finest. He figured they wouldn't make it all the way. They would get within a couple of streets of the old lady's house, and then they would hit the roadblocks. If the old lady could produce proof of name and address, she would be allowed to continue on foot, or in the back of a real government car, depending how much sooner or later they wanted to talk to the neighbor. Either way, she would end up cool and comfortable, plied with water and coffee, talking to polite young women. Safe enough. Chang switched on her cell phone. Also safe enough. Hackett's tracking operation was out of business, at least temporarily. And they needed maps and satellite images and flight schedules and search engines. Mrs. Hopkins had told them Peter McCann's sister was a woman named Lydia Lair. She was younger by a number of years. She had married a doctor and moved away to a Tony suburb outside of Phoenix, Arizona. Her husband was rich, but McCann had asked for nothing except her time and her ear. There was a street address for her, a scribbled note intended for the old lady's Christmas card list, still wedged in a pocket diary in her purse. But there was no phone number. Chang found the husband's practice online, but the medical receptionist wouldn't give out a home number. The phone company database said it was unlisted. Neither husband nor wife showed up anywhere in Chang's secret databases. Google brought nothing back either, except one anodyne image of the couple at a charity event. Dr. and Mrs. Evan Lair, a kidney foundation. He was in black tie and she was in an evening gown. She looked in good health. She glittered with diamonds, and her teeth were very white. Then it became a three-way decision between how soon they would need to get to Phoenix and how long they could wait for a gold card flight and how long the police would wait before notifying the sister, if they ever did. She was not the next of kin. That would be the son. He would be their primary focus. They would want to tell him first. And if they did, they would leave it to him to call his aunt. They would see that as his responsibility, which he might or might not discharge, depending on his challenges. All of which meant, one way or the other, she might or might not be getting the call just as they touched down in Phoenix, which was still okay, either way. Bad news was bad news. Didn't matter when you got it. As long as she didn't have time to start up with a scheme whereby she should fly to Chicago and take charge of everything personally, she had to be gotten to well before that happened, before she was coached into nothing but bumper stickers by victim support officers or well-meaning friends. The best travel bet was outside Chang's comfort zone, on an airline she didn't have a card for. But it was the first and most satisfactory option. It gave them just enough time to stop by the peninsula to dump the P-7 and grab Chang's bag. And one other thing. They fired up Hackett's captured phone and checked the call log. All incoming traffic was from one number alone. Its area code was 480. Chang checked her computer. She said,
"That's a cell phone in Phoenix, Arizona, where we're going."
A very expensive quickie with her phone company guy told them the Phoenix number was a burner cell bought from a local Arizona Walmart just a week ago and registered immediately right outside in the Walmart parking lot.
Bought with cash, and as one of six at a time, which were purchasing behaviors suggestive of a customer who was comfortable with the theory and practice of untraceable communications. Reacher said, "He'll dump that number soon. He'll move on to the next." Chang nodded.
"As soon as Hackett doesn't call him when he should, or as soon as he turns on CNN and sees what's going on here."
"So maybe we should call him first, while we still can."
"And say what?"
"Whatever might produce an advantage. We need to keep him off balance. We need all the help we can get."
"You want to upset him?"
"Can't hurt. Whatever stray emotions we can bring to bear."
"Okay. Try it."
He lit up Hackett's phone and found the right screen and pressed the green button. He heard the numbers spooling outward into the ether, and then he heard a short, hissing silence, and then he heard a ringtone, and then he heard an answer. A voice said,
"Yes?"
It was a man's voice from a big chest and a thick neck, but the syllable was snatched at, and the full boom was bitten back short because of breathy haste and enthusiasm and anticipation, like a gulp or a gasp. This guy had caller ID, and he wanted Hackett's news, and he wanted it bad, and he wanted it right then. That was clear. So the celebrations could begin, presumably. Reacher said, "This is not Hackett." The voice paused and said,
"I see.
This is Jack Reacher." No answer. Hackett got McCann, but he didn't get us. In fact, we got him. He was good, but not good enough. The voice said,
"Where is Hackett now?"
Some kind of a flat, monotone accent. Eastern European, maybe. A big guy, for sure. Probably pale and fleshy. Maybe short of breath. Reacher said, "Hackett is in the hospital, but handcuffed to the bed because the police found him before the doctors. Right here in Chicago. We took his phone and his backup weapon, but we left him with the gun that killed McCann. Unconscious in a suspected terrorist den. The cops found him there. I know, don't ask. Bad data. They were misinformed. But because of it, they'll be sweating him hard. They'll be telling him Guantanamo is in his future. Or rendition to places where bad things happen. He'll be so desperate for a deal, he'll give you up in a heartbeat. Nothing you can do to him, the government won't do worse. So you have that to worry about. Plus you have us to worry about. You started a war, which was dumb, because you'll lose, and it won't be pretty. We're going to beat you so hard your kids will be born dizzy."
"You think?"
"We already beat Hackett. He went down easy." "Was he the best you had?"
"I hope not, for your sake, because you're next. We know your name, and we know where you live, and we're on the way. The time for looking over your shoulder starts now."
There was a long, indrawn breath on the other end of the line, as if more words were coming, perhaps many,
but in the end none were spoken. Instead, the call cut off, and Reacher heard nothing more. He pictured the electronic chip being pried out of the phone, being snapped in two by a blunt thumbnail, the pieces being dumped in the trash. Chang asked,
"Who was he?"
Reacher said, "He didn't talk much, only 9 words. But he sounded big and heavy and Russian and fairly verbal and reasonably smart."
"Russian?"
"From around there. Georgia or Ukraine, one of those new countries."
"Verbal, with only 9 words.
I told him I wasn't Hackett, and he said, "I see," measured and calm, or said in order to appear measured and calm, "This is a guy who understands how words can mean all kinds of different things."
"Do we really know his name and where he lives?"
"I might have been glamorizing our situation a little, or exaggerating for effect, as in, we fake it till we make it, because we will know, sooner or later, somehow. Maybe your phone guy could list his calls by location. There's only a week's worth on that number. He can't have strayed far from home. We could zero in."
"Would the information lead to physical harm or serious injury?"
"That would be its sole purpose."
"Then my phone guy won't do it. That's his deal."
"Do you have to tell him?"
"He would put two and two together after the fact. Then he would go work for someone else. I can't let that happen."
"Even for Kiever?"
"Kiever would understand. So should you. You had a code. A deal is a deal."
"Works for me," Reacher said. "I guess. I expect we can figure it out some other way, after we talk to the sister, who might figure it out for us, depending on how much she knows, and whether it means anything to us."
"Nothing else does. This is not a small thing in a wheat field anymore. Hackett is from California, and he has armorers in Illinois, and his boss is in Arizona. This is a nationwide organization. They'll be watching the airport. You told them we're coming."
"That's why I told them. We won't find them otherwise."
"It's a risk."
"Everything is a risk. Getting on the plane is a risk. All the other passengers have phones. Think of the songs and the pictures. Think of the extra mass." In any event, the jet engines coped perfectly with the challenge the onboard phones presented. Their plane took off smoothly and climbed away, just like every other plane that day at America's busiest airport. Reacher was confident they had not been followed, certainly airside, but their real names were in an airline's computer, and their ETA was widely advertised. Hope for the best, plan for the worst. They had seats together over the leading edge of the wing, window and middle, not the exit row. That was two behind them. Reacher was at the window. Chang had taken the middle, voluntarily. Next to her on the aisle was a woman with earbuds. Reacher said, "I was thinking about the Moynihan cousins, or brothers, or whatever they were." Chang said,
"And?"
"There were two of them, and they were 100 times less trouble than Hackett on his own."
"How are you feeling?"
"Like I got hit 3 times, which is my point, as opposed to 0 times before. I agree with you about Hackett in California and the gun guys in Illinois and the boss in Arizona. It's a national organization. But I don't see how Mother's Rest can be a part of it. Those folks are a far lower standard. They can't be a local division. They would be the weak link in the chain. They'd stick out like a sore thumb."
"So what are they?"
"Clients, possibly," Reacher said. "McCann hired Kiever,
Maybe Mother's Rest hired someone, too. Maybe that's what happens now. Maybe bad guys outsource their muscle to national organizations. Maybe they outsource everything. Why not? It's a service economy. Chang said,
then the sister could be in danger, theoretically, because organizations behave like organizations. They ask for a detailed brief. Did Mother's Rest know McCann talked to his sister? If so, she's in the brief. She's a loose end. Because we are, too. We could meet, and organizations don't like loose ends to meet. Cover your ass is way too important.
Reacher said nothing. Chang said,
what?
I wanted to say I'm sure the sister is okay. She has to be, logically. I mean, Kiever was there just a couple of days, and now we're asking if someone knows his client's sister's address. The odds against would be enormous, surely. Big numbers.
But?
Being on a plane is a helpless feeling. Things can prey on your mind. The Phoenix airport was properly titled Sky Harbor International, and it was a safe harbor, at least airside, because of the metal detectors. Landside was a different ballgame. So Reacher and Chang got off the plane and walked away from the exit toward more distant gates, where they stopped in at a coffee shop and sat on high stools and waited for the last Chicago passenger to be in a hotel bus. For anyone waiting out there for Chicago passengers to have long ago given up and gone home. Then they strolled out, window shopping, infinitely slow, watching for belated recognition, for phoned-ahead alerts, but seeing nothing. The airport was spacious, and crowds were thin, and folks were relaxed. After Chicago, it felt like Sunday. They stopped short of the airside exit and looked at shoes and sweatshirts and turquoise jewelry until the next plane landed and a crowd of disembarking passengers bore down, maybe 100 people, from Minnesota, Reacher thought, with 100 carry-on bags, and he and Chang slipped in ahead of the last stragglers, and they hustled through the baggage hall in a loose, mobile crowd, through the last of the air-conditioned chill, and out to the taxi line, into the baking desert heat. But the wait there was not more than a breathless minute. No one paid attention, no one shuffled, and no one looked at them, and no one looked away. They took the cab to the car rental compound. No one followed. Reacher had no driver's license, so Chang lined up and rented a mid-sized Chevrolet. It was bland and white for anonymity, and it had GPS for getting around. They waited at the document booth and scanned ahead. No idling cars at the curb, no one else around. It was too hot for pedestrians. They drove random and incoherent directions for 10 minutes, and then they set the GPS for the Tony suburb, where the doctor lived, with McCann's sister. They found news radio, but there was nothing from Chicago. No time for it. Apparently, Phoenix had problems of its own. The GPS took them north, and then east toward Scottsdale, then into a suburban street that led to another, and finally to the right development, which had a gatehouse at its entrance. The gatehouse was built in a decorative style, with a hipped roof and cactus plantings, and a red-striped barrier coming out on the right, and a red-striped barrier coming out on the left, like a fat bird with two skinny wings. A gated community. Rich people. Taxpayers. Political donors. The Maricopa County sheriffs on speed dial. They waited at the curb 100 yards short. It was 3 in the afternoon, 5 in Chicago. There was one guard behind the glass. Reacher said, We should have figured.
Chang said, if she's heard about her brother, we'll never get in. Not if that guy has to call the house first, which I'm sure he does.
Reacher said, you have an FBI card?
It's not a badge. He'll know the difference.
He's a rent-a-cop.
He's a human being with a pulse. That's all it takes.
Mrs. Hopkins was impressed by it.
Different generation. Different instincts about the government.
Reacher said nothing.
Chang said,
you okay?
My head hurts.
What do you want to do?
Let's try to get in.
Okay, but any problems, we withdraw gracefully. We live to fight another day. The sister is a bridge we can't afford to burn.
She drove on and turned in and stopped ahead of the barrier, right next to the sliding glass partition. She buzzed her window down. She flipped her hair and turned her head and smiled. She said,
we're here for Dr. and Mrs. Evan Lair.
The rent-a-cop was an elderly white man in a gray polyester uniform, a short-sleeved shirt, thin, mottled arms. He hit a red button. He said,
I hope you folks have a wonderful afternoon.
The barrier went up. Chang drove on through. She buzzed her window up again and said,
I wouldn't want to pay money for security like that.
Reacher said,
the landscaping is nice, though.
And it was. There were no lawns. There was nothing that needed water. There were artful rivers of stone with cactus leaves slashing through like blades, and mists of pale red flowers and steel sculptures, still bright and uncorroded in the bone-dry air. The land was flat, and the lots were large, and the houses were set at different angles, this way and that, as if they had arrived on the scene by accident.
Reacher said, it should be up ahead on the left, a quarter mile, maybe.
Which was where a lot of cars were gathered. All different makes, all different models, all different colors, most of them expensive. They were cheek by jowl on the driveway, three across, three deep, then spilling out bumper to bumper to the street outside, all clustered, all packed in tight, all randomly misaligned, with empty curbs ahead of them, and empty curbs beyond them, as if the house at that location was uniquely and strongly magnetic. Maybe 30 cars in total, which was why the barrier had gone up with no questions asked. There was a message at the gate, a house party, or a cocktail party, or a pool party, or whatever other kind of a party could bring 30 cars over at 3 o'clock on a hot afternoon. The mailbox at the end of the crowded driveway said, The Lair's Lair. Chang parked beyond the last of the curbside cars. They got out in the heat and looked back. The house itself was handsome, wide and confident, one story, a complex roof, part adobe, part rough-hewn hunting lodge, showy enough to at least whisper wealth and taste, but by most standards not really showy at all. Whatever was happening at the house was happening in the backyard, which was not on view. There was a head-high wall running all around, an architectural feature made to look the same as the house, same siding, same color, same everywhere in the association. The front yards were all open, but the backyards were all buttoned up tight, private, nothing to see. But Reacher felt he could hear a pool. He could hear splashing and muted, watery yelps, the kind of sounds people make in pools, breathlessness and the shock of cool water, which would make sense. It was 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It was more than 100 degrees. Why else would people come over?
the pool, the patio, maybe the kitchen and the family room, in and out of sliding doors, cans of beer in tubs of ice. Chang said,
"We did some research in the bureau. I wrote some of it myself, actually. I'm like Mrs. Hopkins. The research was into cars. We worked out a ratio for any given venue between the value of the cars parked outside and the amount of money changing hands inside."
Reacher said, "You think there's money changing hands in there?"
"No, I'm telling you based on my hard-won expertise valuing cars that there are some very wealthy folk in attendance here, and quite a mixture. Those are not just girl cars. There are some couple cars here, even some boy cars, straight from work. This is a heavyweight crowd."
They walked closer. There was a gate in the backyard wall near the garage, wide enough for a ride-on mower, specified years before, presumably, by an architect who thought people would always want lawns, now used as a regular in-out walkway. A landscaped path, rivers of stones, knee-high solar lights, the gates standing open a foot, glimpses of people beyond, packed together, gauzy, sunlit, moving a little. A woman coming out of the gate, carrying a bag to her car, briskly, busily, officially. Not McCann's sister, a friend or a neighbor, a co-host or a co-organizer. Walking fast, coming close, stopping and smiling, saying,
"Hello, welcome, so good of you to come. Please go in."
Moving onward to her car.